WNYC Studios is supported by the Public Theater, presenting the world premiere of Jordans, a new play by Ife Olujobi about two young black colleagues forced together and torn apart by their race, ambition, and otherworldly circumstances. Directed by Whitney White, begins April 11th. Learn more at publictheater.org. WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What if we could block a protein to stop runaway cell division? Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
August 2nd is not getting any further away. Good morning again, everybody. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer, who will return on Monday. There was no shortage of voices this week urging the President and Congress to come to an agreement to raise the debt ceiling, including Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, the credit rating agencies Moody's and Standard & Poor's, and even Chinese government officials. President Obama is scheduled to hold a news conference today at 11 o'clock to talk about the ongoing debt ceiling negotiations. It's his third press conference in 2 weeks. You can watch a live stream of it on our political website. It's afreecountry.org. Joining me to discuss the debt ceiling and other economic news is Diane Swonk. She's the chief economist at Mesirow Financial and our own Charlie Herman, WNYC business and economics editor. Diane, Charlie, welcome back to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Good to be
here. Thank you.
Diane, let's start with you. Can give us a preview of what you expect to hear the president say. More of the same? Do you expect him to once again get tough and talk about Sasha and Malia doing their homework? And
that was a good one for my own kids, I'll tell you that
right.
much. But I think the most important issue here is the idea that we just need to get past the political rhetoric. This is no longer a debatable issue. I think that's starting to get through to some people in Washington, although I wonder about how thick their heads actually are at times. I think the reality that the business community is starting to step up to the plate and say, do you know what you're messing around with here? I mean, this is just not something that's minor. It may be good political strategy, but it's really bad economic policy. And I think you're really going to hear him trying to say, we need to come together. There's movement, there's sub-movement in that, and we need our political leaders to come together and show that America has choices. We don't forego those choices to foreign nations telling us how our debt will be reduced and how our deficit will be reduced. And I think that's a very important thing. This is about freedom of choice. And we give up that freedom by not raising the debt limit.
What kind of tone do you think he'll strike, and how do you think that will affect negotiations going into the weekend?
Well, I really think it's important to be very diplomatic. He's been trying to, sort of be more inclusive in his tone. But I also think it's just very important to, lay it out to the American public how critical this is, that these games are not what we need. I think that, both sides have done major errors in policy. There's blood on the hands of both sides of the aisle. And I think it's time to rise above that. And I think sort of taking a nonpartisan rather than a partisan tone is where we have to go from here. And that, frankly, I think the American public would respond more to that as well, because I think the American public has gotten very tired of politics as usual going to an extreme in Washington of late.
Listeners, do you have a question for Diane Swonk or Charlie Herman? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post a comment on our website. Go to WNYC.org, click on The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm looking here at the caucus blog on the New York Times, a debt ceiling cheat sheet, 8 possible plans. Charlie, there's been so many ideas floated. What's the latest? Where do we stand right now in terms of these negotiations?
It looks like, where we're going towards is perhaps some sort of mechanism by which they might be able to move forward, sort of have a short-term plan. Obama was very much against kicking the can down the road. But we're hearing a lot of talk about the plan from Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, and this idea that perhaps the president would have the ability to raise the debt ceiling at certain points. Congress could come in and say, no, you can't. We disapprove of this. And basically trying to put all the onus on the president to make these decisions to raise the debt ceiling. But I think back to Diane's point about everyone coming together, I think it's so hard right now in Washington. This has become become such a political fight. It would be great if people could sort of put aside their principles to address this issue, but it seems that people are really getting, you know, really stuck in their positions here. This is coming about, this is about a debate about what you think the size of the government should be. Should there be taxation or not? And that's really getting clouded, these political issues, in this economic issue, which, you know, I'm talking to some money managers. They're sort of saying, you got to get beyond this. You have to think about the economics, and Washington's really not doing that.
I want to get to how the markets are responding in a moment, but going back to the Mitch McConnell plan, there's sort of two Mitch McConnell plans. The first one was allowing the president to make these, to raise the debt ceiling himself, with the promise down the road that he would offer some deficit reduction efforts. This latest version is a retooling of that. I understand it has some hardcore deficit cuts in it. Is that correct? Am I understanding that correctly?
And this is all, I mean, it's hard to know specifics of what it could be in there, because a lot of this is being done behind closed doors. You know, they go into meetings and you come out and a lot of information then is leaked, or there's different proposals. I mean, we, as the New York Times, as you pointed out, the caucus room has this good layout of these eight different proposals, because we've started from the grand bargain. We've started from a smaller amount. We've started from just deficit cuts. We've started from deficit and taxes. I mean, they're trying to figure this out in terms of what this will actually be. And while we keep talking a lot about the impact if we go if we blow past this debt ceiling or don't lift it, I should say, what's hard to figure out is what will be the consequences to the economy depending on what the deal is that actually comes together. If we presume that something is created, what sort of impact will this have on economic growth going forward and job creation going forward?
This this hybrid McConnell plan, which is how the New York Times is putting it, has the support of Democratic Senator Harry Reid. Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial, what kind of House Republican support would this deal have if it comes from two Senate leaders?
Well, you know, I'm not a political analyst, but I think at this stage of the game, I think some of the reality is setting in that we have to have something to lift the debt ceiling. Now, I think the important issue here is that we move all, you know, we have to separate the debt ceiling debate from the longer-term fiscal austerity issue, which is complicated everything. And I think we can do that by having some movement towards cuts that both Democrats and Republicans will agree to without getting into the sticky tax issue, which I do think needs to be dealt with, but for the moment needs to be shelved in order to move forward. So I think, unfortunately, we're not going to get the grand plan, and I do understand the need for that, and I absolutely endorse the need for the grand plan over 10 years. But I also think it's important as whatever plan we have and does come forward, comes forward with cuts that are spread over a period in time and is only a beginning. You know, this idea that, you know, we do need to go much further on structural reforms. We do need to deal with entitlements. We do need to deal with fundamental tax reform in this country. And there's, you know, stuff that both conservatives and liberals have fought about. They're now agreeing upon on those issues of tax reform, and it's getting stuck in this idea that, you know, no tax increases by eliminating behavior distorting tax deductions and lowering tax rates. And people are confused. They just don't understand the basic premise of this. And I think we need to get more education before we move forward on that. What I do worry about is what Ben Bernanke worries about, is that in the demand for cuts, in the chaos of getting this, we have too much too soon. We're already, government sector is a drag on the economy. It is shrinking today. Let's face it, that is one of the major headwinds we face. We lost 87,000 government jobs in the last 2 months alone, many of them in education. And we need to deal with the fact that that is already occurring at the state and local level and at the federal level. And unless, you know, we really acknowledge that we're already on that path, you don't want to add insult to injury at this stage of the game when the economy is still so fragile.
Charlie, you had something you wanted to add to that.
Well, I just think what Diane says is that this is a very complicated issue. And there's a recent study from the Pew Research Center and the Washington Post that found that, you know, most of the public, only about 18% feel they really understand this issue. And so it's one that Washington and economists are clearly paying a lot of attention to, but the American public isn't really quite clear the significance of what's at stake here if this ceiling isn't lifted. So, you know, the question that I have is that if a big deal isn't put together, I mean, basically what you heard from Standards & Poor's yesterday when they said that they were basically putting the sovereign debt of the U.S. on credit watch, is that if we don't get a big plan, they may still go ahead and lower our credit rating. And I'm sort of curious, Diane, your thought of what could be the consequence of that if the S&P says, well, the plan you came up with, it's not enough, and we're still going to lower your credit.
Right. They want $4 trillion in cuts,
right,
which was Obama's grand plan, but now we're down to $2 trillion in cuts.
$2 trillion. And that is a very interesting move. You know, the rating agencies have sort of swung into the direction of being overly conservative now after being very easy, as we know, not
yes,
catching a lot of these issues. And I think it is important that the rating agencies play a role here. I also think it's important that they give, you know, what's left of our democracy some time to work. And I do think they're important. I hate to put it that way, but I think they're an important leverage tool. And although we may not, if we get some kind of a plan that says, you know, we really are going to move forward with some kind of automatic, you know, I mean, these you know, the PAYGO rules that we had didn't work, but the ones in the 90s did. The recent ones were, you know, we got to pay for everything that we do today, and that doesn't work. But when you give, you know, legislators a chance to compromise outside of their term limits and say, you know, whatever we do today has to be paid for in 5 or 10 years, that all of a sudden it worked in the 90s, and it does dissipate over time. But I think if we have something in there that looks like it really has some teeth to it, that the rating agencies will take that into account. I don't think they can fail to take that into account. But I do think, you know, frankly, they're playing an important leverage tool as well, saying, you guys, get your act together.
Right.
Talk to each other.
Amy Edding sitting in for Brian Lehr. I'm speaking with Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial, and WNYC's Charlie Herman, business and economics editor. And Ed from Huntington, you're on the line here on WNYC. You have a question for Diane. Good morning, Ed.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is that we are using a tactic of, well, if we don't raise the debt limit, there will be no Social Security, there will be no Medicare, or it will be cut. And I'm saying I think this is an unfair scare tactic to people who are depending upon that to say, well, let's raise the debt limit. I would rather see, I'm 85 years old, and I'm living on basically $100 a week on Social Security. I'm willing to take a cut on that rather than raise the debt limit. And I think it's what this is having an effect on people to frighten them and say, oh, I'm not going to get this. And I wonder if they could maybe cut the senators and the congressman's salary when they cut Social Security.
I wonder
if they could cut their gold-plated medical care system.
I think the first thing, people.
Thank you, Ed.
I have to agree with you on one point, and that is absolutely the first thing I would do as President of the United States and the Treasury deciding the priorities on spending. They don't have a choice. It's immediately 40% to 45% cut. So it's not like they have a lot of maneuvering room. And this isn't just an idle threat, and I think that's something the American public really do not understand. This is not just scare tactics, and I applaud you for being willing to take a cut in your own Social Security, and I'm certainly willing to do that and give up my Social Security entirely because I've made enough money in my life that I don't need it. And so there are certain trade-offs, and you're talking about the exact kind of discussion we need to have. But the first people who should not be paid at all is Congress. And I'm not they're supposed to go on vacation after this. No vacation. You stay around, and you don't get paid because you didn't do your job. And I think, you know, it gets to the issue that Charlie pointed out. The American public really doesn't understand the magnitude. These are not just idle scare tactics. It is very real if we do not raise the debt limit that these are obligations we've already promised that we cannot fulfill now. And it's not that we all can just take a little bit of a cut here, which, in fact, my own company did during the height of the crisis to preserve jobs. We all gave up a little to keep the jobs, and that was, you know, what we could do as a privately held company. That's not the same choice we have given the magnitude of what we would have to cut immediately and the decisions we'd have to make on priorities. And so it's not just scare tactics. There is a lot of reality in this, and I really applaud Ed for saying, listen, I'm willing to negotiate here.
That's
absent from Washington right now.
I think what Ed is saying is this idea of sacrifice, and there has to be a
shared sacrifice to deal
with this. And I think what you're seeing in Washington is people really getting fixed in their positions, and this idea of compromise is disappearing. So here you have someone like Ed who's saying he's willing to take some cuts, and other people saying, no, I don't want any cuts at all. And it goes beyond just Social Security and Medicare. I mean, there was a report that just came out from MF Global, which is an asset management management company. And one of the things that they pointed out was that a lot of federal funds to states and municipalities keep them afloat, keep them going. That federal funds account for about 27% of all state spending. That's a huge amount of money for things like hospitals and education, for road construction. So it's not just Social Security and Medicare. It's a whole host of benefits that really keep the government going that you just kind of expect is there.
And you have a figure for New York City as well, right, Charlie?
In New York City itself, the city said that about 10% of its funding comes from the federal government. And so short term, there may not be a big impact, but that's about, you know, $6 to $7 billion that New York City itself gets.
Larry from Maplewood, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. Yeah, I wanted to ask, why do the rating agencies have any credibility? I'll take it further. Why do any of the financial institutions have any credibility
at all?
And people are actually listening to them based upon their performance during the financial crisis. I mean, it boggles my mind that they're even still around.
Right.
More than Goldman Sachs has any credibility. People listen and quote, you know, Goldman Sachs representatives for what they're saying. I mean, Goldman Sachs, groups like that represent to me bad money.
Larry, thank you for your call. Yeah, the New York Times' Floyd Norris writes in his business column today that the ratings agencies are burnishing their reputation with these tough credit ratings for European governments like Portugal and Ireland, which Moody's downgraded to junk status recently. Diane Swonk, is this just an attempt to try to make good on problems that the ratings agencies caused, looking the other way during our fiscal crisis?
Absolutely. I mean, I have to agree. I mean, the rating agencies, I mean, you know, the incentives are all in the wrong places. We know that this was one of the factors that they don't have a lot of credibility. And I really don't know why they still have the power they do, except the fact that many of the institutional buyers have actual clauses in what they do based on the rating agencies. So it's baked into the equation, and it has not been changed in terms of decision rules. And it is a bit of a laziness among large pension funds and things like that. We've got to invest in these certain AAA things when they may not be AAA. And I do think that the rating agencies are also trying to be much more conservative to, you know, reflect that they haven't lost all credibility, although I think that sort of, to me, that already went out the window. But they're trying to reestablish their credibility. But they do still have this power in the market, and it's really based on these decision rules that are baked into pension funds, institutional investors. Mm-hmm. And we haven't yet been able to escape that because, you know, the pension funds want to be able to say to their investors, we're not being overly risky. We're not, you know, taking, you know, which they did in cases, took right. extraordinary risk. But they're trying to hide behind this veil. And I think the reality is, you know, again, it gets down to individual responsibility and we've, you know, holding accountable. And, you know, frankly, the rating agencies on the municipal bond market are not known for their strength. I'm not sure what their strength is in sovereign debt. But this is not their area of a lot of strength and a lot of, you know, actual individual muni bond houses, mine own included, have their own people who are looking at an A is not an A is an A. We actually, you know, advise people that, you know, different ratings, the same rating mean different things for different bonds.
A lot of our discussion is focused on what will happen if the U.S. fails to raise the debt ceiling. And this is what we've been talking about, too. But what if these immense budget cuts go through? Diane, do you find that your house is your company is starting to look more down the road in that arena?
Absolutely.
How it's going to affect spending?
Well, we expect to have. I mean, we've been, you know, the bottom line is our current spending situation and tax situation is unsustainable. And so we've been looking at these issues in different scenarios for a long time. The question is when, how much, and how much of it will be choice on our part as Americans and how much it will be forced upon us, because there's the two scenarios are very, very different. We've seen the riots in Greece. When it's forced upon you, it's not a very pretty scenario, and it's not clear you can get out of it. We actually, I just got back from Europe in a bunch of meetings with international economists representing some 40 economies, and they're baffled. They can't imagine we wouldn't use our own freedom of choice that we value so much in this country to choose our path, since we still do have time, latitude, and flexibility to make we don't have the same kind of pain facing us that many other countries do. And why not choose the path, our future, rather than have the rest of the world choose it for us? Why would we give up that freedom?
When talking about how Americans are starting to pay a little bit more attention to this, but still are not really focusing on this debt ceiling issue, which is what a lot of Washington is focused on right now. The jobs report released last week by the Labor Department revealed only 18,000 jobs added in June. The unemployment rate inched up to 9.2%. lackluster numbers, to be sure. Charlie Herman, is our real economic problem jobs?
I would say that fundamentally, yes. That is what is usually of top priority amongst polls. This Pew report that I mentioned earlier, the economy was number one at about 87% in terms of priorities listed by Americans. Jobs was 84%. And the debt ceiling was much lower. But the one thing to keep in mind with this debt ceiling debate is it does tie into these issues of taxation and spending and the role of government. And that does have an impact on the economy, clearly. And that'll have an impact on job creation. And this is where you start getting into the principles of the different parties in terms of the size of the government and what it does in terms of helping the economy and helping job creation. But with all this focus on this, I think that a lot of people don't understand why are we paying attention to the debt ceiling? Why are we talking about this when we still have this really high unemployment rate that's been consistently high for several months now? What is being done about that? And with the trends that we're seeing are reversing the job growth that we saw. So there's questions about what the government can actually do. And again, this gets back to these principles. Less government, the private sector can, you know, step into that void and create jobs. Others saying there needs to be more stimulus, that there needs to be more government action to get hiring happening. What the answer is, I don't know the specific answer, but there is a general sense that Washington is not focused on the issue that the rest of the country cares about, which is unemployment.
The conversation continues online, WNYC.org. Click on The Brian Lehrer Show. Charlie Herman will be rejoining us in the 11 o'clock hour when President Obama is expected to give his latest news conference on this. Perhaps, Charlie, we'll see if any news is made or if there's just more of the same of, hey, kids, let's get to work.
Eat your peas.
Eat your peas. Do your homework. Diane Swonk, Chief Economist at Mesirow Financial, thank you so much for joining
us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. Coming up, we go to Borough Park and find out how that community has been dealing with the death of an 8-year-old child of one of their own members. Stay tuned.